and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson. Joining me in a bit will be Peter Salmon, and we're going to tackle this week's new review. The second movie in 2 weeks that we have reviewed with a black female filmmaker, which I believe is sadly a first for the show, but a great way to sort of queue up things next month, because of course February is Black History Month. February begins on Monday, so there's a lot of stuff going on in terms of Black History, and of course we're slightly more aware of that, and the Black people in our community who have contributed so much and have not often gotten the credit they deserve. And so we're going to get into a bit of that with this week's review, which we will hear about shortly. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new semi-quasi-historical drama One Night in Miami, which you can now stream on Amazon Prime Video. Before that, though, we are going to kick off this week's show with, I don't know what to call it. But, you know, one of these little listicles we're coming up with, because sometimes movie news in a week is so scarce. We have to find other ways to kind of keep you entertained. And also because we're, like, in lockdown and things, you know, maybe it's something you're looking for. Things to watch, things that are a bit outside the immediate, or the immediacy of your Netflix queue. So, 25 years ago was 1996. So, just, you know, taking a quick overview of the life of film in 1996, it was kind of a crazy, kooky year, for movies. It was interesting looking back, because, like, of course, movies now are all about sequels and franchises and continuations and spin-offs and all that. And there wasn't, like, a whole lot of that looking back in 1996. It was a big year for the start of franchises. You know, so things like Scream was released that year. And we'll talk about Scream more in a minute. Mission Impossible. The first Mission Impossible movie came out that year. When you're talking about things like like we have now with, like, these sequels and continuations and remakes and things, and trying to make franchises out of weird things. I mean, it was the year of Mars Attacks. Mars Attacks, of course, was this, I don't know if it was ever really popular, but it was this, like, gruesome card series about Martians attacking Earth with death rays, and they turned that into a movie, an enjoyable movie, I will add. I've enjoyed Mars Attacks on several occasions. But also 101 Dalmatians. Disney released a live-action version of 101 Dalmatians, which is the kind of thing you would expect Disney to do now. You would fully expect Disney, because that's what their business model is turning live-action movies out of their old cartoons. And they did do that in 1996. But now it's, you know, well, that was kind of an oddity in 1996 to kind of do that. Now it's become such a main tenant of Disney's release strategy. In terms of, you know, sequels, there were actually a lot of sequels released in 1996. They were abominably crappy sequels for the most part, or kind of things like Homeward Bound 2, where the pets from Homeward Bound get lost again, or All Dogs Go to Heaven 2, Crow City of Angels, which was objectively the worst Crow sequel until you get Crow Wicked Prayer several years later, which stars Edward Furlong, Tara Reid, and David Boreanaz. It is putrid, to say the least. Do not watch Crow Wicked Prayer alone. It will drive you to consider some things. Anyway, there was at least one decent sequel that year, and it was Escape from L.A., this, like, crazy, cocky John Carpenter sequel to Escape from New York. It's still featuring Kurt Russell as Snake Plissken, but on the other side of the country. I'm planning on revisiting it again at some time soon. Anyway, here are 10 movies from 1996 that I think kind of sum up the year. This isn't necessarily the definitive list of the best movies from 1996, but it is a sort of, how I think the year kind of falls in terms of like the movies that made 1996, in my personal opinion. So I'm gonna st this is in chronological order, so from the earliest release to the last release for of 1996. So this is not an again not an indication of quality or not a definitive ranking, shall we say, but I'm just gonna go down the list. So starting with early in the year, From Dusk Till Dawn, this movie came out a little over a year after Pulp Fiction came out. So at this point in the 90s, everybody's trying to come up with their Pulp Fiction. And I remember this from like media class too in high school. Anyone who was like kind of like seriously thinking about getting into film was kind of making their Pulp Fiction. It sounds kind of silly when you're thinking about it, but I mean this is what was going on in 1996. So this is like two movies smushed together. It was written by Quentin Tarantino, co-starred Quentin Tarantino. But the first half of the movie is basically a Quentin Tarantino movie, with these two criminals, played by George Clooney and Tarantino, taking a family hostage, trying to get them out of the United States and into Mexico. And then when they get to this establishment whose name I cannot say because this is a family radio station, and then it becomes this a vampire movie, and that's kind of where the Robert Rodriguez influence comes in, because Robert Rodriguez did direct it. But it's kind of interesting watching this movie and seeing its two halves. Hand one off, hand, if the Tarantino movie hands it off to the Rodriguez movie, it's kind of interesting. Next on the list, I have Beautiful Girls, which comes from Ted Demme, who is the nephew of Jonathan Demme, the Academy Award-winning director of Silence of the Lambs and other things. It's an ensemble drama. I have a feeling that if someone tried to make Beautiful Girls now, they would turn it into like a 10-episode Netflix series, which I feel would be, I don't know, kind of too much. Let's just say it's too much because it takes place like at this high school reunion weekend, incredible ensemble cast. Rosie O'Donnell's in it, Timothy Dutton leads the cast, Michael Rapaport's in it. The two kind of standouts are very young Natalie Portman in it, who plays this like sort of worldly wise 13-year-old who lives next door to the family home of the Timothy Dutton character. And then it also has Uma Thurman in it, and she is kind of glorious as a sort of laid back, cooler than thou person who kind of comes into Timothy Dutton's life at a really odd time. And she's Uma Thurman was kind of the it girl at the time, so it's kind of plays into that rep a bit, but also unwinds it. She's more laid back in it. She's less made up. It's a really cool role for her, and a really interesting movie. I mean, it's very talky, but it's the kind of independent movie that typifies the era of the mid-90s that we don't necessarily see anymore, because if you want to make a movie like this, you have to turn it into a 10-episode show, probably for Sundance Channel or something like that. Next, I have Bottle Rocket, which is Wes Anderson's debut movie. It doesn't necessarily feel like a Wes Anderson movie now looking back, because it's not this meticulously crafted thing, like down to the costume and the production design and the certain patches somebody has on their jacket or whatever. But it is very much in, it establishes Anderson's tone, at least in terms of the friendships involved, the unusual friendships, the unusual characters. It really, though, has this kind of feeling that would not be necessarily out of touch, I think, and the filmmakers that we talk about next, which is Fargo, the Coen brothers. Fargo, I hesitate to say it's their masterpiece, but it does feel like It does kind of feel like it. It is sort of everything they were leading up to with the sort of the hard-boiled crime stuff and also the quirkier character-driven stuff. It feels like it amalgamates those two sides of the Coen brothers' personality really, really well. And at the center of it, you get this wonderful performance by Frances McDormand. It's interesting to sort of think about it in the what comes 10 years, almost exactly 10 years after this, with No Country for Old Men, which is kind of like a very similar feel, a very similar type of story about dumb crime, and a worldly investigator who has to sort of unravel it all, and the one kind of psychotic character, who takes things up to 11 in the midst of it all. But unlike the Tommy Lee Jones character in No Country for Old Men, who comes to the conclusion at the end that the world is just this terrible place that one must survive, Marg, at the end, she's basically doing her job. This is probably the worst, most terrible case she will ever have to deal with in her life, but she doesn't necessarily bring that home with her. She's, of course, heavily pregnant in the film, and her husband knows none of this. He's kind of a stay-at-home dad type. And, when you come to the end of the film, it's just like, that was a day in the life. It was a terrible case. It was a terrible crime. And they're not going to let it bring them down or ruin this nice little life they've built for themselves. It's less cynical in a certain respect. Next, I got James and the Giant Peach, which is the follow-up from by Henry Selnick to Nightmare Before Christmas. I almost said Nightmare on Elm Street. But he kind of takes the Roald Dahl story and makes it his own thing. It is not, I mean, Burton produced it, Tim Burton produced it, but it is also not a Tim Burton thing. It's kind of like raw Selnick, his vision, which is very much influenced or in a similar mold as Burton. The two of them work together, but this is a very interesting piece that stands on its own, separate and apart from like the Burton oeuvre. Selnick is very much pouring his own artistic sensibilities into it, which are Burton-esque in a sense, but also more light, more fun. And I feel like it kind of gets stamped out because of the overwhelming cultural influence of Nightmare Before Christmas. Along with that, similar but different, you have the Disney animated movie that came out in 1996 was The Hunchback of Notre Dame. It's like this middle piece between Pocahontas and Mulan. And granted, Hercules came out after Hunchback, and almost feels like a response to Hunchback to a certain extent. But if you take these three in the 4 year stretch where you have Pocahontas, Hunchback, and Mulan, where Disney is trying new, weird, dare I say, darker things in the process. And it is really, it's this piece of art that really stands out because Disney's going whole hog. I mean, yeah, there's goofy gargoyles singing and dancing and jitterbugging or whatever, but there's also this character voiced by Tony Jay who is just unrepentantly evil. And there's all this talk of sin in it and hellfire, and it's so dark in places. I can't believe Disney released this in the summer as their family-friendly animated movie. It's like someone at Disney really dropped the ball that this was able to slip through the Disney factory, the Disney like bleaching floor, the disinfectant. That's the word I'm looking for. It also features a character. A lot of talk is made about the Princess and the Frog, and that was Disney's first quote unquote princess of color, or black princess. But you have Esmeralda in this, who is a woman of color, granted voiced by a white woman, Demi Moore, and the optics of that are not great 25 years later, but it is worth noting that, even 15 some odd years before you get Tatiana. I think the princess's name was Tatiana and the Princess and the Frog. You get Esmeralda in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. For something completely different, there's Train Spotting, which is just this, you know, if Reefer Madness is sort of one depiction of drug use, you get Train Spotting as the anecdote, which just shows these characters sort of reveling in filth and struggling to get out of this bad place they have found themselves in because of the heroin. And kind of like there's no real proper resolution. Granted, the Ewan McGregor character gets out at the end and chooses life, as it were. But it was not an easy path to get there, and it certainly wasn't a morally righteous path to get there. And Train Spotting really rubs your face in all of that. Long Kiss Goodnight, which is like Shane Black's sort of last straw at Hollywood before taking a decade off and coming back with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. But in The Long Kiss Goodnight, it's really set. I mean, it was a box office failure at the time, and it's kind of it gets sewn into the film history with Cutthroat Island, which was also directed by Rennie Harlan and also starred his wife Geena Davis, and they made these two back-to-back big budget bombs at the same time. But it is so much more than that. You know, you can see the DNA in The Long Kiss Goodnight and things like Alias and things like the work of Angelina Jolie in the 2000s. So like things like Wanted and Salt. You also see even going all the way up to Atomic Blonde. That movie starring Charlize Theron that came out a couple of years ago. I'm not sure those things would exist without Long Kiss Goodnight, and I think it is something that's worth revisiting from this time period. I've run out of time, so I'll just have to do the last two really quickly. Romeo and Juliet, which of course had the really great soundtrack. It's the meat, so to speak, the middle of the Red Curtain trilogy from Baz Luhrmann. Also, the start of peak Leo as teen heartthrob, and then of course Scream, which I mentioned earlier, launched a new subgenre in horror, brought back the slasher, brought back Wes Craven. Of course, the Weinsteins like nearly grounded under thumb when they realized it was a Mundy maker and started running it off the printing press, running Kevin Williamson into the ground by trying to put his stamp on absolutely everything that was coming out, from Halloween H2O to The Faculty. It is really quite remarkable that anyone made it out of the late 90s alive, working for the Weinsteins and the grist for the mill. Anyway, I'll have to leave that there because we do have something completely different coming up after the break. We're going to review One Night in Miami. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Sam.
Boy, your paranoia is really cramping my style now.
Come on, just because you can't see bugs don't mean they ain't in the house, Sam.
Up on this dirty-ass roof.
Why don't you be like Bing Crosby about that, man, and accentuate the positive? Look at this view.
I bet they're doing them for me. It's nice, ain't it, Malcolm?
Yeah, it's most definitely soothing, Cass. The air up here is cooler.
Far away from the prying eyes of your G-men.
Yeah, you joke all you want, Sam. I'm telling you, it's got worse since the tension between me and Mr. Muhammad. Well, I met with a writer in New York a few weeks back. There were two guys following us through the airport. I swear it was the same two.
I thought you didn't trust writers.
Oh. This one was a brother, and well, this meeting was important. I figure I better start getting my life story documented in my own words while I can.
And that was a clip from One Night in Miami. It's the new film from Regina King, and it stars Kingsley Benadire, Eli Gorey, Aldis Hodge, Lance Reddick, Michael Imperioli, Joanna Calagongo, and Leslie Odom Jr. So I'm now being joined on the line by Peter Wesley Salmon. Peter, how are you? This is our first show of 2021, so happy night.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I've been doing good. Christmas was fun, New Year's, all that jazz. Back at the U of G, you know, any students listening, I'm there with you. You know, we got this, y'all.
In spirit, you're not
physical. Yeah, in spirit. Well, I did a lot of Zoom discussions, but yeah. Yeah, no in class.
All right. We were talking about this before we started recording, but there have been some get-togethers on campus, which is a big no-no.
I know, partying.
And this is why our movie this week is extra unique, because it is about a gathering. In February 1964, an imaginary gathering. It's called One Night in Miami. And Peter, you suggested we spend one night in Miami with these four historical figures. So what drew you to One Night in Miami?
Oh, I just, there's multiple reasons. I just love Regina King, or, you know, I don't really know how you can't. Watchmen was probably my favorite work of 2020. It was great. Sandy Wexler. Right? Come on now. Cinderella story, you know? She's just great. She's great all around. And, you know, she's got a lot of talent. So I was just curious to see her work. I also was aware that she directs a lot of TV shows. And I like a widespread amount. So I do enjoy, me some Good Doctor and some This Is Us. And she's done some great episodes for them. I've just always loved the history from, you know, I'd say late 50s to early 70s. So for this, the 60s, you know, so getting to see, you know, I, even though a fictionalized version, it was very fun getting to see someone playing Malcolm X, Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, Jim Brown, Sam Cooke, you know, I really liked that. You know, it was fun seeing them all together and getting a glimpse at them. I think what was really interesting about that in comparison, because they all pretty much have, you know, some sort of biopic. I'm not sure about Jim Brown or Sam Cooke, but I know the other two do. And we saw a different side of them that we don't see. We saw them all just together as friends, right? Not having to worry about the public and the audience that was seeing them. So I think that's something that stood out to me. It was a portrayal of Malcolm X I don't think we'd see anywhere else and have seen anywhere else thus far. Denzel Washington is a phenomenal actor, and Malcolm X by Spike Lee is one of my favorite films. But it doesn't give a main focus to Malcolm X questioning the Nation of Islam, having confusion, doubt, and all of that, right? Near the end, kind of like I'd say the last quarter of it, that is the period where Malcolm X was dealing with that. But it's a lot more just, you know, quick kind of shots, him going to Mecca and everything like that. And there's not as much dialogue through him during that period as Kingsley Benadire did. So I thought that was amazing. A side of Malcolm X that I haven't seen portrayed. Just phenomenal acting, and I think a really, really fun arrangement. And yeah, I'm a Regina King fan. So,
I agree with all of that. I think Kingsley Benadire is really great as Malcolm X. Kingsley Benadire is an actor he's an English actor, I think, but he's, you know, he's popped
what
up.
What was
in...
his name? He better be. So British.
You're not wrong. But he's one of those actors who's, you know, been building his portfolio and building his resume and has popped up in different things. And yeah, he's a real standout here. And it's because, you know, Malcolm X is allowed to be vulnerable, is allowed to have doubts. We see him a lot talking to his wife and his kids and being the family guy. And
See, that's present in everything. And I was glad they continued that. I really do think that's something about Malcolm X that needs to be remembered.
And the thing about the Spike Lee movie, and I do like that. I do like that movie too. Interesting to note that it was originally going to be a Norman Jewison film, but it's Spike Lee, you know, doing a Spike Lee thing. You know, he's kind of, I don't want to say he's mellowed a bit, but he kind of has. So, I mean, that's like, so Malcolm X is kind of like Spike Lee at his most militant. And I don't like necessarily saying he was calling him militant, but it's kind of his at his most passionate. This is like Spike Lee, who was doing the press rounds for Malcolm X, saying like, he only wanted black reporters to interview him about the movie. So this is Spike at the height of his, like challenging the social order of things. So that's obviously reflected in the Malcolm X movie, which is, doesn't, it feels like it goes against the Spike Lee aesthetic to show those soft corners of Malcolm X.
Oh, absolutely. And that's again, that's what was special about this.
Right. So because that's like the most prominent Malcolm X movie, it's sort of the beat that everybody has taken from it when portraying Malcolm X on screen, ever since, even like in Selma, because Malcolm X has a small role in Selma.
Oh, I didn't know that. No, that's cool.
Yeah. It's not Malcolm X himself, obviously, but I'm an actor playing Malcolm X. I can't remember who plays Malcolm X in Selma, but that's kind of like really the great highlight of the movie is this, I hesitate to use the word, but like this humanization of Malcolm X. He is not the great totem that he is otherwise, seen in other versions of his story or whatever part he plays in other stories. And it's just, I mean, we focused a lot on Kingsley Ben-Adir, but the whole foursome. Eli Gorey as Cassius Clay, before he becomes Muhammad Ali. Aldous Hodge as Jim Brown, although I think the Jim Brown character is kind of under service to an extent. But
I was just about to say, I thought he was great. You just didn't like the way Jim Brown was portrayed, or
I thought it was fine. I just thought that if you're giving out, like, in terms of the meat being spread out amongst the four, Jim Brown got the least amount of meat.
Yes, but I think that was partially intentional. Because he's the one that he's kind of found his path. He kind of knows who he is, right? Whereas the other ones are all representations of the path they're taking, who they want to be, their confusion. And it deals with how they are all finding their identity, who you are and what they believe in, right? And he is the one who's already found his place, and I think that's why he didn't need as much discussion. He's also just more of a quiet guy. I didn't think about that. I guess he did have less dialogue. I also thought he was more of a quiet man, but I can see why you thought it wasn't layered as well as it could be with all four.
It just seems like the most drama is in the three others, and of course the fourth person is Leslie Odom Jr. as Sam Cooke. It just seems like Jim Brown's role in this, and this is based on a play too, so I'm not sure how it all shakes out in the original play, but it just seems like Jim Brown's part of this, and it may be because, as you said, he's kind of got
the middleman.
He's got it more figured out than everyone else, but he is the middleman. When things get hot, he's usually the one who pulls one of the people aside and, you know, offers some wisdom or offers a break and, you know, lets the others cool off. It's an interesting dynamic that way, but I mean,
it's one too, that like something that was needed in the 60s, right? Especially for black people who were, you're dealing with all this, the changes, and trying to find more equality, right? But it can also be attached to anybody, finding yourself, confusion and everything, right? And I also think it's very relevant now as well.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the, you know, race as well, not just what I was saying, more of a broad view.
Right, because inherent in the whole story is this idea of how, if you're a successful black man, what responsibility do you have to give back to your community, and how do you give it back? And maybe this is the last thing about Jim Brown I'll say, is that there's obviously a bit at the beginning where you meet each man before they have this meeting in Miami. The Jim Brown scene that introduces him is...
That stood out to me,
It's probably one of the most powerful scenes in the film, because he goes and visits, as you know, but I'm explaining to our listeners, he goes and visits a family friend. He's just had a really great season in the NFL, and he visits a family friend, played by Beau Bridges, who's like probably the more affable of the Bridges brothers. So... So he goes and visits his family friend. They're sitting on the porch. They're having a great conversation. And there's this tension this whole time, because he's a young black kid talking to an older white man in the South, Georgia, I think. And so they're having this conversation. You eventually see Jim Brown relax. And, you know, that tension kind of...
Bull Bridges is so nice to him, right? Like, he's talking...
But you expect... You expect the white Southerner to go white Southerner any minute. And you slowly see the tension melt away. And then the daughter comes out and reminds Beau Bridges that he has to move some piece of furniture. And Jim Brown says, oh, I'll be more than happy to help you. After this collegial conversation, Jim Brown reaches out and says, I would be more than happy to help you. And Beau Bridges just says, and he says it straight. There's no kind of...
like, he says the bad word.
There's no record scratch about it. He just says, oh, Jim, you know we don't let N-words in the house. And he just says it so flatly. And it's just, you see it on Aldis Hodges' face, just like this. You could see the spiritual slap across the face, just the way he casually lets loose this word. That even after all the pleasantries and the glad handing, he's still just that to this man. And
Well, and it's supposed to show too that, like, he was one of, in Georgia, he was one of the better ones than some of the others, right? But that's not cool, right?
Yeah, it shows
all the flaws.
It's just such a, like, as a moment, it just floors you. It just levels you on.
It gave me the shivers. Yeah. You said the most strong thing in this film. I'd say it's the most strong moment in any film I've seen in the past while. It really gave me those shivers.
The casual racism of it is it just blows you away. I mean, I don't know if I'd have to give it some more thought, but it is for sure one of the strongest moments in the movie. I'm not sure it's the strongest moment in the movie, because there are a lot of really strong moments, but the Jim Brown story starts just so strong like that, and it just really doesn't seem to go anywhere.
There's nothing he can do about that.
except to the set of The Dirty Dozen, which did tickle me. But it shows him at the end on the set of The Dirty Dozen, which
that was cool. Yeah. that was really cool.
Being a fan of that movie.
some of his films I've seen too, and he's a really great actor. And the one thing that they just briefly mentioned is him having that record, right? Do you know if he still holds the longest yards record?
I don't know.
I'll check. Okay, it wouldn't surprise me, because the way they kind of brought it up in the film seems like he might have been, but yeah.
It's hard to say. I mean, records are made, records fall, and that's kind of the way it is in sport.
But that was kind of a nice thing I found too. Even if you don't know these people, it's fun kind of to learn more about them, right? Like Sam Cooke. I didn't know about Sam Cooke. I didn't know he performed or had other, you know, people do so much ghostwriting, and he had so much help with all that. And I loved his earlier music too, so I never really thought about the comments that Malcolm X made towards it, right?
That's a really...
And another standout scene is Sam Cooke, the concert that Malcolm X went to see him, where the microphone breaks, yeah. So he has to just kind of get his own song going with the audience. Such a great scene. And it's who is it that screws him over? Rick.
It's Jackie Wilson.
Jackie Wilson, yeah.
Who sabotages him? It is no accident. And I think Sam Cooke says Jackie Wilson is the king of sabotage, which I have not heard before. But
cool. I may have to
look that up.
The playwriter just might have not been a fan.
It's that, I mean, that's possible too, but yeah, that's another really powerful scene. Like
numerous.
The way he, cause people are starting to boo, and even his own band abandons him. So it goes to show, you know, talent is about more than just, you know, great songwriting and great lyrics. You know, it's about the nature of the performance too, and the way he kind of turns it around, and people start the stomp and the clap, and as he's performing the Chain Gang, and it's the scene is really well constructed too, because you get it from Malcolm X's point of view at the back of the theater.
Yeah,
and, it's yeah that. I think that's maybe my favorite scene. I don't know if it's the best scene, but I think it's my favorite scene because it's about the power of performance and about the power of like sort of this of like group like making music as a group. It's not, I was going to say it's a group sing along, but it's not really a sing along. But it's this kind of audience engagement thing, the kind of thing that only happens when you're in an audience. At a music show, you can't really replicate it just sitting there listening to music, which of course a lot of this is about too. And yeah, I found the Sam Cooke storyline, and not just because he's kind of like the artist of the group too, but because he really is. I mean, that the kind of the meat of the story, the themes of, you know, the responsibility of giving back to the community who so much has been taken from, and it seems to be the exclusive responsibility of the few Black people who are able to get out and be successful to give back to their own community. But I think one of the great arguments of the in the film is with Malcolm X talking about, you know, what you know, the Sam Cooke's responsibility is. And Sam Cooke tells the story about an artist he represents, how they had this song and it only went to like 90 on the Billboard pop charts. But then the Rolling Stones wanted to do a cover of it, and it goes all the way to number one. And that artist gets the royalties for that because he wrote the song. And he comes back and gets the check, and he comes back and he says, oh, the Rolling Stones want to make any more of my songs. So it's, you know, what is the more value that this artist singing his own songs makes it to number 90 on the charts, or this artist selling his song to the Rolling Stones, making it to number one and making all the money, even though the Rolling Stones get the credit? What is the more value? Those are tough artistic questions, especially in the music business, that, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, and he's the opposite to like Malcolm X, right? When it comes to their viewpoint and how they want to, you know, go about things when it comes to racial matters. So I thought, again, Sam Cooke and what he did just represents how well they represented the different paths and that could be taken. Sam Cooke just kind of, I guess, accepting the world and trying to do the best he can with it. And then Malcolm X wanting, you know, a full change.
Right. And there's a scene in it where Malcolm X plays a Bob Dylan song, and he says to Sam Cooke, it's like, this is what you should be doing. And later on, Sam Cooke, here's one of these conversations with Jim Brown, where he says, you know what? I want to do what Bob Dylan's doing, and I've been working on this thing. And of course, the song he's working on is A Change Is Gonna Come. And it's interesting that he never to show the dynamics of, like, of, you know, strong men bucking horns, but, you know, there's never an exchange where Sam Cooke says to Malcolm X, you know, I am going to do my part as an artist too, and instead he just kind of reveals this on the Tonight Show, the first time that A Change Is Going to Come, the first and last time Sam Cooke himself performed A Change Is Going to Come, I learned, was on that episode of the Tonight Show.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, because he died.
Oh, okay.
In a I think it was before Christmas, 1964, under very odd, mysterious circumstances that there seems to be more than one version of that story, which I won't get into, but it's notable that and I wish the movie had kind of addressed it a bit more, that, you know, in this moment where Sam Cooke takes sort of artistic responsibility for the movie, not just like a business responsibility, but like an artistic, he's making an artistic statement about the movement. And just in that moment when he puts that stamp on the, there, he unfortunately passes away too.
Oh man.
That it's just like in this singular moment where you know, because Malcolm X was died in the same year, that the two titans of this movie, just as they're sort of like proving their point, end up having to leave the stage, as it were. I feel that that could have been more of an exclamation point, but I mean that's not the choice Regina King made, and she made so many good choices with the movie. I won't presume to second guess her on that.
Well, because it's based on a play, and it is like other ones based on plays like Fences, where there's a couple scenes, but it's the majority of it is set in one location. Maybe she thought kind of going even further into the death of Sam Cooke might have kind of pulled away from that. Yeah, because the Malcolm X one, she didn't even, there was no visual of it. It was just a quick little message about his passing. I'm not gonna lie, I didn't read the full thing. Did it mention Sam Cooke's passing in it too? Or
no, I didn't mention that Sam Cooke.
See, that was weird. I think that should have been done. But like I said, I think if that were to happen, it should have just been kind of done in the same way as Malcolm X.
Oh no, I would have been fine with that. I just felt it's kind of like a thread that's left dangling. But I mean, again, that was her call, because she did kind of allude to the fact that, you know, Muhammad Ali stayed with the Nation of Islam while Malcolm X left. And you do see in that scene Muhammad Ali's regret about that. Like, he's wearing that regret on his face. Like, I wish Malk and I were still kind of in this together, as opposed to, you know, feeling any kind of real vindication of you know, taking on his Muslim identity. And I mean, that was really a perfect way to sort of leave that, to show, just to show that, because Muhammad Ali actually said that, you know, turning his back on Malcolm X was like the biggest regret of his life.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. So that was, yeah, that was done well. And that last scene where he gets, into the Nation of Islam, I thought was really cool. Just visually, it was stunning.
It was a good,
it would look a huge, huge amount of people. It was a lot more than I was expecting. Huge old scenery, set design. And I thought it was really, and it's accurate too. I've looked into, you know, what they wear. I thought the fashion design for it was remarkable, with the men and women and what they wore, you know, black and white, the separation. And I know you could view it as a little bit in your face, but it is how they, it was how the inaugurations into the Nation of Islam looked. So
yeah,
it was just all around accurate. One thing I noticed though, even though Elijah was in it, I didn't, was there even like one mention of Farrakhan, or was he there? I didn't see him sitting like next to Elijah or anything. Maybe they had to ask him, but he just didn't. He said no. I'm not sure.
I don't know. There's no mention of Louis Farrakhan.
Yeah, good old Farrakhan.
I mean, it's tricky because of he's kind of like a straw man figure now, to an extent. And I don't think they needed to mention Louis Farrakhan. I think it's his presence is kind of there. I don't know if in the scene where of Muhammad Ali's induction into the Nation of Islam, if there's somebody sitting on the stage or the dais and somebody says, you know, okay, just remember, as you're sitting here not saying anything and taking part in this ceremony, remember in the back of your mind, you are Louis Farrakhan. I don't know if there was that instruction to one of the extras or not, but otherwise it goes unmentioned, which
yeah, I'm just always curious if it's legal matters, because he's got so many lawyers and everything, you know.
That could be it.
Yeah, I really don't know. Still kicking.
He is still kicking.
And Nation of Islam doing well. That's also why I was kind of glad they did this film. If you know, it's kind of starting to bump again. So I thought that was really sweet. Mm-hmm. Well, I never left, but it's starting to be, I guess, kind of like it was here. Very important, but also kind of cool. Like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, yeah. Not kind of cool. Very, very cool. That's how they, you know, kind of pulled people in. I really liked some of the smaller roles, especially Brother Kareem, who was a member of the Nation of Islam. Lance Reddick, he was great.
Lance Reddick, he was really good.
That guy from Lost that we all know, but not his name. But now we do.
Was Lance Reddick on Lost?
Yeah. He's like one of the evil dudes. Yeah.
Was he?
Well, not like he's one of the people that.
I remember he was on Fringe.
Yeah, no, he's on Friends. He's on Lost too. He's one of the main people that works for. He's trying to get the guy back onto the island, right?
I'm gonna look this up because I don't remember Lance Reddick on Lost.
He is. He's in like five.
Oh, episodes. Oh, he is of Lost. On Lost.
He's in like five episodes. Yeah,
he's in.
He's
four
the secondhand. Episodes. He's the secondhand man to. Yeah, but it's like important stuff.
Okay. Okay, he was there. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, now, he's the secondhand man to the guy who was kicked off the island back in the day, because Benjamin Linus. Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's all coming back to me.
Yeah, I'm blanking. I feel bad. I watched Lost like five times, but I forget. I'm blanking.
I haven't watched
Lost. Yeah, he is in it, and he's great. But... I watched it like early, late last year. I'm just haven't had enough coffee.
And Lance Reddick is in Godzilla vs. Kong, too, coming out in a couple months.
Oh, really? That's cool. He'd be great for that.
Well, I mention it only because they, as we're recording this, they just posted the new trailer for it a couple of hours ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it. Kong and Godzilla fighting on top of an aircraft carrier. That was pretty sweet.
I'll watch it.
I'll watch it, too. Back to One Night in Miami, though. I did appreciate that this is a stage play, and like a lot of, or I mean, the source material was. For the most part, I didn't notice until they get into the hotel room for the meeting of the minds, because I mean, there's just this feeling, and it's kind of hard to overcome when you're adapting a play. So I cut Regina King some slack on this, but it's that moment where they all come into the hotel room. It's like, okay, the stage is set. They have entered the stage.
Yeah, kind of. I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing, though. But
it's
yeah,
not necessarily a bad thing. That's the only moment I was like, oh, I'm watching a play. that was kind of the one moment where that it kind of stuck out.
Could also have been kind of on purpose in the sense that a lot of shows that are for the most part a bottle one, but start somewhere else, just do that quickly the first part, and then immediately get into a more kind of bottled episodes. Mm-hmm. Vibe going. So maybe that was her intent. But I do agree that it was a bit of an abrupt change when it comes to the,
mm-hmm.
the viewpoint you're giving it, and what it kind of the feeling it's putting out there.
Right. It's not like Rope, though, where it feels very much like it was based on a play, and it. I mean, for certain reasons, because Alfred Hitchcock was doing the kind of all in one shot kind of deal with that as well, but there's ways you can do this that makes it feel bigger than the play, and this kind of finds that balance really, mm-hmm. really well. But that moment where they come into the hotel room, it's like, oh, they've all entered the stage. Now the play's beginning. But other than that, that's fine. What else did I like?
I just want to quickly say, Charles Whitmore is who Lance Reddick works for. I swear I didn't look it up. It came back in my head. I was overanalyzing. I'm a Lost fan. I apologize. But I got the name back.
All right.
But yeah, no, I understand what you're saying with that. You didn't make any comments after. Wait, did you like Brother Kareem? Did you think Lance Reddick and the other,
oh, no,
other
Lance
little dude did well?
Lance Reddick is great and everything. The little dude mentioned.
He was fun.
Christian Magby is his name, who plays Jamal, who's the other guy who's kind of guarding the room as they're meeting. I did like his scene.
His comparison, it being pretty much the, and he didn't even mean it in a bad way. He meant it in a good way, being the same pretty much as a game.
Yeah.
And also, I think Brother Kareem, he did a very good job of, yes, he's helping out Malcolm. You could definitely tell he's working for Elijah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's...
Because there's a couple things where it's just, he would just randomly brought up questions to Malcolm X and kind of gave some behavior that was definitely... every once in a while, he even almost felt a little above Malcolm X when it comes to the Nation of Islam level. And I love the other small thing of how when we would hear Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X doing their prayers inside, we'd get just a little quick shot of him outside holding his hands in the proper way. I thought that was just a little small thing, too.
Yeah, no, he's Lance Reddick is great in everything. So you really felt that tension in those scenes, and you don't need to have a necessary grounding in the history of the politics, I guess, around the Nation of Islam to understand that there's a lot of friction at this time, and you can sort of feel it in those scenes. The other thing I was going to say is I do want to praise the singing ability, which is not...
I was just about to say that.
It's, you know, because he is, of course, a great singer. Leslie Odom Jr. was in Hamilton, of course.
The film too, right? The stage, and he's the one that they picked for the play, I believe, like the Disney Plus.
Yeah, the Disney Plus concert film was the original Broadway cast, so he was there.
And I think Leslie Odom Jr. still does him. I think he might still do Hamilton, even, or he might be done. Yeah, I don't know. But for some reason, I feel like he still does Hamilton.
No, he hasn't. He hasn't done it since.
Okay, well, he's doing some other great stuff.
But I mean, he's an exceptionally busy actor.
His voice outstanding,
because he does a really great job. I don't know, why would you call it an impression? I don't know, the end song where he's performing a Change Is Gonna Come, I'm not 100% sure if that was a lip sync. But I was listening to his version of a Sam Cooke song he performs in the film, and then I listened to the Sam Cooke version, and it was kind of hard to tell them apart. So I wouldn't put money on it being a lip sync.
I think it might have just been him. He's a phenomenal singer.
Because
he's really outstanding singer. I've listened to his singing because he's been on a couple podcasts I watch. And I also would find it very, very surprising that he allowed them to use, that he allowed lip syncing instead of his own voice. But yeah, we'll look into that. It was lip syncing. It was, his dancing was good, and it gave a good aura kind of going.
I mean, it's possible. I'm leaving it open to the possibility it was a lip sync, but I'm more than willing to believe he was actually performing at least that song. I mean, there are other scenes in the film where he's performing where I think he is he's singing with his own voice.
Yeah,
it's just that last song. But I mean, he is really, really good. He really, really captures those cadences.
I also enjoyed how Sam Cooke, he had like a little subplot of this song, right? This wasn't just something at the end or something that started with his discussion with Sam Cooke, or sorry, with Jim Brown. It was something he'd been doing since the very beginning when he was just in his own hotel room with his, I'm not sure if girlfriend or wife, but
I think it was his wife at the time.
Friend, LaVere. And yeah, so it started then, and I thought it was really cool, kind of spread out in a very subtle way. It's a very, especially a subplot like that, it's very impressive for something that is mainly set in one setting, you know? So I thought that was cool. Also, the other big scene, we mentioned the Nation of Islam one. The boxing scene was phenomenal. And Malcolm X, the photo he took, if you look at it, it's what they had in his camera after he took the photo is the classic Muhammad Ali one that, you know, you can see everywhere. It's the Muhammad Ali one that they sell every year at the poster sales.
The very famous Muhammad Ali picture, yeah.
Yeah.
It's, it turns out that Malcolm X is was an avid photographer, which is a little detail about Malcolm X you would not get.
Well, because they mentioned, and Sam Cooke mentioned it himself, he said to Malcolm X, you know, you're still, a lot of you is the same, but you're becoming more of a persona, you're becoming more of something fake. You're even when you're off camera, you're like the Malcolm that's on camera for the civil rights movement, right? I like Sam Cooke kind of pointing that out.
Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid I have to point out that we have reached the end of our review segment for week. So,
but yeah, Peter, you'd recommend it, right? You'd say
I would absolutely recommend
it. Yeah, One Night Miami is one of the best I've seen, I think, in a while.
I would concur. And if you want to pick a fight with Peter,
as per usual, Mr. Tarak, YouTube and good old Twitter. TikTok, Peter Wesley Salmon, like my name. So yeah, check it out, y'all.
And that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. And if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com, downloaded from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean, or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Speaking of that Spotify app, you can find the playlist for all the music you hear on End Credits every week. Just search for End Credits on CFRU in Spotify and hit play. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can find me at GuelphPolitico.ca, my news and politics site, or you can read my writing about horror movies at NOFSpodcast.com. That's Nightmare on Film Street at NOFSpodcast.com. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. We will be back here next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for more End Credits, and we will see you then.